Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Wednesday, March 16, 2022. The time is 1:33 p.m. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Myers, Senator Hughes, and myself as Chair, Senator Holland. Senator Schauer will be excused for the day, probably not going to make it. We do have a quorum to conduct business, though. And thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Nate, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. I will now bring Senate Bill 115 back before the committee. It is related to providing a confidential address to certain persons. This is the second hearing of Senate Bill 115 in Senate Judiciary, and I did not receive any amendments for this Senate bill. Are there any amendments that did not make it by the deadline? Seeing no proposed amendments, is there further debate?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question that I asked last time. The sponsor said he was going to look into it. My understanding, we were going to have somebody from the DMV online, and if they have done so, I would appreciate being able to just kind of field my question to them.
I don't see anyone from the DMV online at this time.
We do have an answer.
Oh, you did?
A division? Oh, maybe that means DMV. All right. Well, so what I will do is probably ask you to restate your question.
So my question was, and I see Senator Keel chomping in the bit as well, but my question was effectively that it's my understanding that with the Real ID law that was passed in 2005, that in order to get a Real ID compliant driver's license or other identification, which is actually required for some occupations such as mine, that you have to supply your residential address to the DMV, and I was wondering how that impacted with this bill.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. excuse me, and my staff has come to the table to correct me when I say something wrong. We did check with the DMV on this question. In order to get a Real ID, a person does need to provide their actual address to the state. The
physical address.
Their actual physical address to the state. However, the DMV has laws that where if someone has a confidential address, the DMV will hold that confidential. And so if, for instance, someone needs to give you notice of an abandoned vehicle that's registered in your name, the only address they'll get is your address protection program post office box. Likewise, the address on your ID will be your address protection program address, not your actual physical address. I'm going to look at my staff and see if I screwed that, if I made a terrible mistake.
I was going to ask Mr. Creo if he wanted to vouch for the truthfulness of Senator Keel, but
through the chair in answering to Senator Myers' question, Senator Keel did wrap up the question very nicely, and I just wanted to add that DMV data is confidential by statute, and the specific statute that the DMV got back to us was AS 28.15.151.
All right. Thank you, Senator Myers. All right.
I'm satisfied, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further debate? Senator Hughes.
I continue to have my reservations because I believe that if this is good for victims, for other folks, I think they have the option to get their own P.O. box, and we have an indeterminate fiscal note. We don't know. I am somewhat reassured by the sponsor of the bill's estimate that I think he said 900, maybe 900 would be involved, but it is going to take, I'm assuming, Department of Administration staff time to do this, and when we don't know how many, I don't know that it's really necessary for that we're doing this, but I'm not going to hold up the bill, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further debate? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the administration. I believe that Brad Ewing, who is the director of the Shared Services of Alaska program at Department of Administration, is on the line. My thanks to the administration for Mr. Ewing's work. He sat in, participated in a call that my office arranged with administrators of these programs in other states, which are, of course, much larger. But beginning the serious work of digging in to look at exactly what the Department of Administration would need to do to implement this program. So that analysis is ongoing in a very serious way, and I believe as this bill makes its way through the process, we'll have a very clear-eyed analysis of that.
A question, Paul?
Senator Hughes?
And to that, I know you mentioned other states last time too, but remind us, are other states adding law enforcement correctional officers, or are they just doing it for victims?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Hughes' question, other states only do for victims and survivors of certain crimes, usually, as with this bill, domestic violence, stalking, and sexual assault. My estimate had been based on population and just those numbers, I would have estimated to the committee about 600 participants. So I put in a fairly generous guess for the number of law enforcement and correctional officers who might take advantage of this.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Senator Hughes. Thanks, Senator Keel. Senator Keel, would that have been your wrap-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So with that being Senator Keel's wrap-up, I will look to Senator Myers for the will of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the Senate Judiciary Committee substitute for SB 115, Work Order 32-LS0. We got the right one. 0380/G, or be reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Just trying to confirm G is the correct one. Yep. All right. Without objection, Senate Bill 115 has been reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We'll do a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. At this point, I'll bring Senate Bill 161 before the committee. Invite Senator Wilikowski and his staff to the presenter's table. Senate Bill 161 is related to the definition of political parties in Alaska. This is the second hearing of this Senate bill in the Senate Judiciary. I did not receive any amendments by the deadline. And at this point, I will ask, are there any amendments? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one conceptual amendment here. I believe we've been able to pass it out to the committee members. We'll go ahead and I'll move conceptual amendment number one.
I will object for discussion.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So,
brief at ease. Back on the record, Senator Myers, since this is a conceptual amendment, do you care to read it for everyone who doesn't have a copy of it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will. So it simply states that after the new definition that we have, after the word state on page one, that we insert a sentence, after each decennial federal census, the Division of Elections shall by regulation adjust this number by the percentage the state's population has changed since the 2020 decennial federal census rounded to the nearest 500. And the only reason that I wanted to bring this amendment forward is because, as I mentioned during the last hearing for this bill, it's been nearly 40 years since this statute was updated. And I have a funny feeling that since this is a portion of the statutes that we don't look at very often, that it might end up being another 30 or 40 or 50 years before we look at it again. And just the way that populations can change, I wanted to keep us roughly in line. I agree with what the sponsor is trying to do, both in terms of setting both in terms of lowering the barrier to become a political party, and in terms of getting rid of that complicated formula that's currently in the statute as well. So I definitely agree with the sponsor of the bill there. I just wanted to keep us up to date as we move down. Move through the times.
All right. Thank you. My objection will remain to this conceptual amendment. I'll look to the sponsor. Do you have some thoughts on this conceptual amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage and Jay Bear, here with me is David Dunsmore and my staff. Talk to the amendment sponsor, Senator Myers, and I don't have any objection to it if the committee sees that that is an appropriate way to go. I guess I would just want to clarify for the record that this would not apply to the 2020 census, but rather it would apply after the 2030 census. I think that's the intent. And we talked about, I think we had the same idea when he was writing it. My preference, I think, would be to have keep the number 5,000 in there and then have that adjusted with rounding up or down. Our suggestion was 500 rather than putting in 0.68%, which is what Legislative Legal did, I guess, when they were drafting the amendment. I just think that adds a little bit more level of complexity. We want to make this as simple as possible. I like the idea of a bright line number that's in statute that political parties can look at and say that's the number we have to shoot for. So that, I have no objection to it if the committee sees fit.
Senator Hughes.
And I like tying it to the 5,000 rather than to the population. But I did have a question because what Senator Myers read, the last phrase was rounded to the nearest 500. So are we talking about the population rounded to the nearest 500 as we calculate it? Are we talking about rounding the registered party members to the nearest 500?
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the way that I had this envisioned, and I believe the way that we've got it written right here, is that we would be rounding the number of party members necessary to the nearest 500. So if the next census goes up and we end up with, all right, according to this calculation, instead of 5,000, it should be 5,427. We round it up to 5,500. Next time around, if it goes up to 5,700 and some odd, then we round it back down to 5,500. So that's the way that I see the intent here, and that's what I hope we would get out of Ledge Legal and or the drafters of the regulations at DOE.
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, and I figured that was it, but I just thought the way it was written, because the closest noun is the word population, so getting that intent on the record I thought was important.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Is there any other discussion from the committee? I will probably maintain my objection because I do prefer the bright line. And we do have another opportunity to amend this when we see it on the floor of the Senate. And I am a little uncomfortable with talking about the 2020 decennial, what the phraseology is going to be. Honestly, we have 10 years between now and 2030 to have some legislator, including yourself, draft a really good amendment that we would see on the floor of the Senate. So I'll maintain my objection at this point. I think it's a great idea, but I worry about what the outcome of this will be once we give it to Ledge Legal for conforming and technical changes. I'd rather we nailed it down. We know what we're going to be looking at ahead of time. Having said that, is there any further discussion? I'll maintain my objection.
Yes.
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 No. With three yeas and one nay, the amendment is adopted. And are there any other amendments? Seeing none, is there any further debate? Senator Hughes.
A discussion and not debate. I was just wondering, because it was adopted and assuming it goes the way it goes, when the chair brought up a bright line, bright number, is that something that Division of Elections would have posted? Okay, after 2030, now the number will be 5,500 or whatever. Would that be something that individual Alaskans are trying to scrounge and figure it out? Or is there going to be a bright number that would be available through Division of Elections?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, Bill Lukowski. I have a strong suspicion that Division of Elections would post that information online and make that readily available.
Okay, thank you.
All right, with no further discussion, Senator Wilkowski, do you have any wrap-up?
I don't, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the committee's discussion, and like I said, I really don't have a real strong feeling about the amendment. If somebody wants to pull it out in the floor, I'm okay with that too if it doesn't come out the way that it was intended.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. I will look to Senator Hughes for the will of the committee.
Right. This is 161, right? Okay, I move that Senate Bill 161, Work Order 32-LS1361/A, as amended, be reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Without objection, Senate Bill 161, as amended, has been reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And, of course, the committee authorizes Ledge Legal Services to perform conforming and technical changes. We'll do a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. All right, Senate Judiciary is back on the record. I will now bring Senate Bill 189 back before the committee. 189 is related to sex trafficking. This is the sixth hearing of Senate Bill 189. We do have a draft committee substitute for this bill that we should discuss. I'm going to make a motion, but note that I intend to withdraw it after we debate it. So I will move to adopt the proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 189. Work Order 32-GulfSierra2029/B as our working document. Do I hear an objection for discussion?
I will object for discussion purposes.
Thank you, Senator Myers. At this time, I'd ask Mr. King to go to the presenter's table. And Mr. King, would you briefly describe the changes in Version B?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ed King, staff to Senator Holland. Mr. Chairman, the draft Version B, it was a major restructuring of the bill. So the bill was redrafted to conform to legislative drafting guidelines and resulted in several technical and conforming changes throughout the bill. Most notably, Section B leaves the sex trafficking statutes where they are now in 1166 and amends that current law rather than moving those sections of law to 11.41. Mr. Chairman, there were also five clarifying changes in the vacatur of judgment section of the bill requested by the court system. One explicitly states that the petition is granted if no action is taken. Second, it clarifies that the petitioner is not entitled to a jury trial. Third, it directs the court to remove a case from court view within 30 days if there are no felony charges involved in the case. And lastly, it moves the effective date of the vacation of judgment process to give the court system more time to develop forms and procedures.
All right. Thank you, Mr. King. At this point, I'd like to ask the Department of Law to the table. If Mr. Skidmore cares, come take the presenter's table. And I see you have Ms. Schroeder out there. I don't know if she has. Okay. All right. So, Mr. Skidmore, can you discuss or can you talk to us about the difference between keeping the sex trafficking statutes in AS 11.66 versus moving them to Alaska Statute 11.41? And what is the purpose with that?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of Senate Judiciary. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the Alaska Department of Law. The question posed is whether or not having the crimes found in 1141 versus 1166 makes any difference. Does it matter? I would submit to you the answer is yes. The difference between the two is that 1141 is a crime against a person. 1166 is characterized as crimes against public decency. When the statutes were originally enacted, they were enacted back in 1978. And they were promoting prostitution seen as a problem of public decency and not wanting to have public decency infringed upon by those engaged in this particular industry. However, in 2007, the state of Alaska changed the crimes from promoting prostitution to sex trafficking. They really only changed the titles at that time. But as a 2019 article from Loyola Marymount, that was a study in Alaska of sex trafficking, notes that it was really only in 2013 that the country as a whole began to recognize the harms or the ills associated with human trafficking or with sex trafficking. I would remind you of the comments that I made when we opened on this bill, talking about the notion that sex trafficking is truly just modern day slavery. It is someone subjugating another human being to essentially be a sex slave. So what's the difference between 1141 and 1166? They're both crimes, right? I would submit that you all consider the statutes that this body has passed over the last 50 years as a state and ask yourselves, does the legislature treat crimes against persons in 1141 differently than they treat other crimes in Title 11? I would submit to you the answer to that is yes. Let me give you some examples. Alaska Statute 1230.055 talks about a petition to revoke probation. And a person who is charged with a petition to revoke probation, that's someone who's committed a felony, is put on supervised probation, has now violated probation. That's the filing that's occurred. That's the petition. And the question is, does that person have a right to bail? Under this particular statute, the answer is yes, except for 1141 offenses, because they were crimes against a person. Consider protections provided to victims in Alaska Statute 1245.042. This particular statute says that when there is a victim to the crime, the defense cannot compel a mental examination of the victim to determine if the victim has some sort of mental ailment that somehow contributed to what happened in this crime. That statute says the ability to compel those mental exams are limited. You cannot do it to a victim of an 1141 crime, a crime against a person. Consider 1145.046. That's the one that says that a victim's under the age of 16, they're entitled to a guardian ad litem. And that guardian ad litem can ask the court to have the victim to be able to testify by closed circuit television. That's not available to any other victims of a crime outside of 1141. Consider right to be told about OVR. Alaska Statute 1261.010, subsection 15. Again, an 1141 crime. Alaska Statute 1261.120 that protects the release of a victim's address and phone number applies to an 1141 crime. Look at the investigations, 1250, 201. Law enforcement is authorized to temporarily detain witnesses when it's to a crime of an 1141, a crime against a person. All they need is reasonable suspicion, and they can detain the witnesses. Consider what's happened in sentencing. Alaska Statute 1255.011. A victim or a defendant can propose what they think the sentence should be to a judge at the time of sentencing, except for an 1141 crime, because it's a crime against a person. Alaska Statute 1255.027, subsection G1. Electronic monitoring credit can be applied if the person had electronic monitoring pretrial for crimes, except an 1141 crime against a person. Alaska Statute 1255.127, consecutive sentencing, says that you can have concurrent sentencing when you have two crimes, but not when it's an 1141 crime. It has to be consecutive. I could go on, but I think the point that I'm trying to make for you all is that the legislature has throughout the statute books, and we've only looked at Title 12, throughout the statute books, there are policy calls that the legislature has made that when you commit a crime against a person, that is fundamentally different from the other types of crimes that occur. And so what you all have to ask yourselves is sex trafficking truly only a crime against public decency? Are we talking about prostitution? Or have we come to understand sex trafficking is something altogether different? A crime that targets the most vulnerable in our population, homeless, runaway youths, addicts. These are the people that are sex trafficked. And if you look at the elements of the crimes that are proposed here, we're not talking about people that engage in commercial sexual conduct because they've chosen to do so. We're talking about people who engage in commercial sexual conduct because they were forced to, because they were too young and influenced by someone much older than them to engage in this conduct. The way in which this happens tells you
that it's a crime against a person, not against society, not against decency. Does it violate those things? Sure. But we're talking about harms to an individual person, the victim of sex trafficking. And it's for those reasons that I humbly submit to you, the administration thinks it's more appropriately categorized as an 1141 crime. You all, as the legislature, are policymaking body. You all enact the laws. You all decide how you want to characterize and classify that criminal conduct. I would encourage you to consider these differences and ask yourselves, do you think that sex trafficking is simply a crime against public decency? Or do you think it truly belongs as a crime against a person and therefore should carry with it those additional safeguards or penalties that the legislature has already decided should apply to 1141 crimes? That's the fundamental question that's in front of you. And it's one that you all will have to wrestle with and decide for yourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a statement. Harkening back to how Mr. Skidmore began his remarks, she said that sex trafficking is a form of modern-day slavery. I would tend to agree with that, and I would say that if that's not a crime against a person, I'm not really sure what is.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Senator Kiel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Skidmore, I haven't been through every line and letter. Does the reorganization you object to, let me ask this a different way. The crime of prostitution as currently constituted includes both the buying of sexual conduct and the selling of sexual conduct. Separate from the trafficking crimes, you are suggesting also moving that to 1141 or leaving that at 1161?
Through the chair, Senator Kiel, we have not proposed moving prostitution. Prostitution is still a crime of public decency. It is not a crime against a person in the way that sex trafficking is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That makes sense to me.
Thank you, Senator Kiel. Senator Hughes.
Oh, I was going to simply say you did an excellent job making the case for 1141. That was it.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Were you just surprised it was so short?
You blew me away. Could you repeat that? Please.
Oh, really?
Seriously.
Oh, I was just saying you did an excellent job making the case for it to be under 1141.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. So, Mr. Skidmore, and apparently there is some resistance to have this moved from one location to another. Do we know, have statutes been moved before as they have been developed to different locations in the Alaska law based on some new interpretation of it? Or is that even the proper phrasing of that question?
I think it is, Chair Holland. And the answer to your question is I'm afraid I don't know. Okay. I don't know if there are sections that have been moved before. I think that what the drafting manual discusses is that if you are not making a substantive change to the underlying statute, you don't simply want to willy-nilly move them around. And in fact, there's actually Alaska statutes that indicate that the reviser, who works for you all, has the ability to determine where things are appropriately placed in the criminal statutes. That's their power. It's absolutely their power, and they get to make that decision. I think probably what's happened is that there was the fact that the administration had not yet presented its rationale as to why this should be in an 1141 as opposed to 1166. If you simply look at the two statutes, what we're proposing to change it to, what it currently is, I don't know if I would agree, but one could certainly argue that there's a lot of similarities between them. I think we're making substantive, significant changes, but I would acknowledge someone could probably make the opposite argument. What I don't think was made clear prior to today in any comments that I or others of the administration have made is why the move to 1141 has other implications other than just the exact words in the statutes that are changed why there's that difference between 66 and 41. And I'm hopeful that my comments today will help alleviate some of that.
Thank you, Mrs. Goodmore. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, and the reason it was put in 66, I'm just wondering if you know the history in that the perception, I think, back in the old days, was that the people involved in prostitution that were sex trafficked, in society there was this thought that they're as guilty as the person running the business. And now we recognize that just because someone is out on the street corner as a prostitute, they actually may be being forced, and we understand that now. And so because of that, the insight we now have is very much the reason I'm thinking the administration does want to move it, because we're recognizing I wouldn't be surprised if virtually all the prostitutes, but a vast majority of them, are not doing it of their free will. They are being coerced. So it makes sense that we, now that we've wakened up to that fact, that it needs to move.
Senator Hughes, I would actually, through the chair, Senator Hughes, I would take it one step further. There's actually case law in 1972, a case called Johnson v. State. It was October 6th of 1972, and it was addressing prostitution prior to the enacting of the Promoting Prostitution Statute. The interesting thing about this statute, or about this case, it actually answers a previous question that we had. I think Senator Meyer was asking about the corroboration aspect. In this particular case from 1972, our Supreme Court actually indicated that the reason that in those cases, prostitution cases, you needed additional corroboration beyond any other type of case. It was sort of an odd thing. Why would you say you need something more? And so the statute we talked about that says no corroboration is required was specifically enacted to repeal this particular case. But the significance of the case is that in that case, it actually says that in prostitution, there is, and I quote, no injured female within the meaning of that phrase used in another Alaska statute. It goes on to say that the possibility an accusation such as this is made can be motivated by spite or abnormal psychological condition that has not yet been recognized as being greater than any other non-sexual offenses. In other words, what I'm saying to you is that our Supreme Court back in 1972 found that prostitutes couldn't be trusted in and of themselves. There had to be corroboration, because our Supreme Court, audaciously at that time, said people who engage in prostitution have psychological problems, have other issues that make us not want to trust them. And so, again, I come back to the concept that prostitution was about public decency, the selling of oneself for sex. And who in their right mind would do that? But people are doing it, and so there are these other things associated with that. And what we're saying now, first in 1978, they said, clearly we don't want to adopt that, but it's still about public decency. And what we're saying now is that sex trafficking is something that has only more recently been come to understood. I'd submit to you, it's really only in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. And sex trafficking is a completely different animal. We're not talking about prostitution. As I indicated earlier to Senator Keel, that's still staying in 1166. We're talking about something fundamentally different, modern day slavery, sex slavery. And that's why it's a crime against a person. And that's why I would submit to you, we're more enlightened now than we were in 1972. And we recognize this is a crime against a person.
Thank you, Ms. Skidmore. Senator Hughes.
So I use the word prostitute as someone who might be a sex slave. Are we now using a different word for a person that is the one that is, yeah, the victim that is, are we not using the word prostitute? Did I misuse that?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I would tell you that a prostitute is someone who is willingly engaging in that conduct, who has not been compelled or forced into it in some other manner. That person is a victim of sex trafficking, and we actually define that term in our bill.
Okay, thank you.
All right, are there any other questions regarding this? So please stay, because I have a few more questions for you. But at this point, I'm going to withdraw the motion to adopt the committee substitute. So we still have version A before us. But there were a few questions that came up, and so I have a few. If you care to speak on, are there any potential constitutional issues with the vacation of judgment infringing on the governor's power of the pardon?
That's a very interesting and an excellent question, Chair. I would tell you that there are a couple of basic things that folks need to understand in the Constitution and the separation of powers for the different branches of government. First, for the legislature, you all are very clearly the body, the branch of government, who enacts laws. You all decide what's criminal conduct and what isn't. Nobody else can infringe upon that. That is your sole exclusive role. The administration, the executive branch, engages in the enforcement of the laws, and only to the governor is given a power of pardon or clemency. But the power of pardoning or clemency is about a circumstance or a situation in which that executive says, I know this person has committed a crime. I know that they are guilty of that crime. But I am going to excuse them. I'm going to show mercy on them for some other reason. And there can be many and varied reasons. However, the legislature can decide when they want to decriminalize certain conduct. You also decide when you think there should be defenses to conduct that you would otherwise have said were criminal. And that also enables you all as the legislature to then say when you think that there are categories of crimes that something should be adjusted with. The executive is doing it individual by individual. Sometimes in the executive, I think in the federal government, they've had the executive pick a whole bunch of folks that were all charged with the same type of crime to provide some clemency. But again, that's on an individual basis. Even though they've selected a whole group, it's on that individual basis. So it doesn't violate the separation of powers when you all say, as in here, we want to indicate that someone who has been convicted of this crime, if they can prove this defense, that means that the crime can be undone. You're not looking at an individual. You haven't picked out Sally or Anna or Fred or Joe. You haven't picked out a person. You are talking about the conduct of what is criminalized and where you think those defenses ought to be. Now, our state in Alaska, we're still a fairly new state. We don't have case law that talks about that, but that is something that flows logically from it. I can tell you that there are other states who have addressed this. California, for example, looked at this very question, only they looked at it in homicide cases as opposed to sex trafficking. And in that case, the case is People v. Lamoureux. It's a 2019 case that's cited at 42 California Appellant 5th 241. In that particular case, they concluded that it did not violate the clemency power of the governor for the legislature to create a defense or to authorize a defense or to lower a mens rea in a crime and then to give people the ability to have that crime vacated based on their change in the law. In fact, you could argue that Alaska has something similar right now in statute. It's called post-conviction relief. Post-conviction relief indicates that a person can seek to have their crime removed from their record if there's a significant change in the law. It's actually found at Alaska Statute 12-72-010, subsection 7. The challenge for post-conviction relief is that it's currently limited. You all put this limit in place, that it has to be done within 2 years of the conviction. So I wouldn't recommend lifting that two-year limitation, but I would suggest to you that that also indicates that you already have the power to do precisely what we're proposing here. We propose not to do it under post-conviction relief. We proposed a different method, but to do the same concept. And so I would submit to you that the concerns that it would somehow infringe upon those clemency powers, while I can understand that concern, I think that further research or review of it would reveal what I've just indicated, that it's actually not a constitutional problem for you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Mr. Skidmore's conclusion. I'm not sure I agree with his reasoning. I do think that we have examples of group exercise of the clemency power, both in Alaska. There used to be Christmas clemencies. Mm-hmm. And I think nationally, we saw President Lincoln's amnesties were applied to a group. But I think there are other really substantive differences between the clemency power and what we're discussing here. The first of which is that the governor's clemency power does not apply to municipal convictions, whereas this vacatur of judgment does allow the Alaska court system to vacate a conviction under a municipal code. So that is a material and substantive difference. I also think, as I read Article 3, Section 21, that the governor's clemency powers, while very, very broad, don't actually allow him or her to vacate a judgment. Pardon, commutation, and reprieve are not the same. And so this is a different type of remedy. It's not, in my view, an impingement on or a usurpation of the governor's executive clemency power. So same destination, but a different reasoning to get there, I think.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Win-win. No. So I have two more questions, okay. As I do. Another question is, do you see any equal treatment arguments that result from vacating a prostitution charge, but not other similarly situated misdemeanors stemming from being a victim of sex trafficking?
To the chair, no. The simple answer to that is that individuals are not similarly situated when they're charged with different crimes. I do believe that you all have the ability to decide, do you only want to apply this to prostitution? We had some discussions earlier whether or not you all would want to apply it to other types of crimes. It's a policy call for you all to make. But whatever crimes you were to select, they will be differently situated because they have committed different crimes.
And the last question I have is, could you imagine a situation, and I think you had cautioned us against we try to imagine situations, but could you imagine a situation where a person could be engaging in prostitution in their own home, a home they own, without involving any other sex worker, but that could result in the conviction of sex trafficking and the forfeiture of their home?
My short answer is no. You would have to be careful about the way in which it's drafted. Our drafting that we had proposed to you all for sex trafficking talks about trafficking of another person, not of yourself. This was actually an argument that we heard and had a lot of debate about back when SB 91 was moving through the building about whether or not a person can be convicted of sex trafficking themselves. We looked at the statutes. We didn't think you could sex traffic yourself, but I think there was a single case, an instance in Fairbanks in which a law enforcement officer had filed a complaint against an individual for sex trafficking themselves. When that complaint was referred to our office, we dismissed it because we said, no, that's not a thing. You can't do that. But I think if the language of the statute was not carefully drafted, you could have someone that would try and reach that interpretation. But I think so long as we draft the statutes carefully, that is not, nor should that be, an interpretation if possible.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Senator Hughes.
So you mentioned it would be a policy call if we were to allow other crimes to be vacated. And I'm just wondering, in the situation where you're vacating the crime of prostitution, are there other associated things that are very tied? For instance, I'm wondering, and I don't know if this happens, but someone that is in the, that is a victim of sex trafficking, are they ever exchanging and taking money for drugs during that interaction with the customer, for instance, and might have that kind of crime on the record? Are some of these victims told they need to improve dress better or whatever, so they're shoplifting so they can look more attractive or whatever? Are these kinds of things are very much tied to the what they're doing in the sex trafficking trade? So are those kind of things often, are they convicted of things like that that you could tie to the fact that they're being sex trafficked?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I don't know how frequently there may be convictions for that type of conduct. I would agree with you that there is certainly those circumstances in which drugs are either being traded or provided to get someone addicted, or once they're addicted, withheld from them. So there could certainly be drug use that's associated with it, and therefore criminal conduct that's associated with it. In fact, when you look at the crime of coercion or some of the elements that we put in, it's that threat of an accusation of a crime that can coerce somebody then to engage in sex trafficking or human trafficking. Likewise, if you have theft, you've persuaded, the trafficker identifies their target, develops a relationship with them, encourages their target then to go and commit this crime, say of the theft of whatever it may be, and then says to them, you now need to do X, Y, and Z for me, or I'll report you for this theft or this crime, whatever it is we had you commit. That is definitely one of the methods that is used for sex trafficking. So there is some support for that notion. Again, I say it's a policy decision that you all can make, is are there crimes that you would want to identify for those purposes?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Are there any other questions for Mr. Skidmore while we have him here on Senate Bill 189? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Skidmore. At this point, I have two questions for the courts. And if Nancy Mead would come to the presenter's table. My staff does a good job of writing these questions down as they pop up from various locations. I'm going to try to read this one and see if I read the words correctly and if it means the same, if have you seen these questions yet? Or you don't know yet?
I am uncertain.
Okay. Well, the first question has to do with current language around a vacation of judgment. Could it create a situation where a person could enter an invalid petition and have another crime vacated because the prosecutor didn't object?
To the chair, for the record, this is Nancy Mead, general counsel for the Alaska court system. I believe you are speaking to Section 34 of the CS, or would you prefer I refer to the original?
You have probably the original if you have it handy. A brief at ease. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. Nancy Mead, please proceed.
Thank you again, Nancy Mead, for the record, general counsel for the court system. To the chair, I think your question is referencing on page 20 of version B with respect to the vacation of judgment for those convictions. Line 29 says that if no response is filed, the court shall grant the vacation of judgment. Of course, this should never happen because the preceding sentence says the prosecuting authority shall file a response within 45 days, but this is a sort of covers that rare, hopefully, situation where none is received. And your question goes to the fact that, well, this directs the court to grant it, but what if essentially the petition filed by the individual who has that conviction on his or her record is fundamentally flawed or does not allege any facts or something like that? And I do see your point. Our plan to implement this would be to create a form that invites and requires certain information to be submitted. However, I can now imagine a situation where that information is not, blanks are left or something very insubstantial is submitted to the court, and strictly that line 29 would require the court to grant the petition nonetheless. Given that concern, and I do understand it, maybe the language should say the court may grant the petition without further proceedings. That would accomplish the same goal in my mind, the goal being to not have a useless hearing where nobody's opposing the relief that's asked for. And perhaps, again, if it said the court may grant it without further proceedings, it would authorize the court then more explicitly to seek more information before it is required by the statute to enter something that may not be advisable or reasonable.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mead. Any questions for the committee? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a response to something that Ms. Mead brought up. In the preceding sentence, the prosecuting authority shall file a response within 45 days. If we're providing the ability for the courts to grant that if they haven't gotten a response, maybe we redraft that sentence to say that not that they shall file a response, but that just to say that they have 45 days if they want to respond.
Is me?
Through the chair to Senator Myers, that would be okay with me. As I think about how this is likely to be handled by the prosecuting authorities, I frankly would expect very few responses, because I can see the city prosecutor, who is responsible for many of these convictions, and the DA, who are very busy offices with a lot of priorities, perhaps not prioritizing opposing something that happened 20 years ago that was a B misdemeanor. So as I think of how this would go forward, I believe that it may be the case that whether it says shall or may, we will not receive very many responses.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Ms. Mead. Any other questions? And then the other question I have is, you had previously stated that about 66 out of 1,000 convictions of prostitution involved another charge. I guess this was for vacating the ease of getting rid of the charges publicly. Do you have any numbers related to how many of those multiple charge cases involve a felony?
To the chair, I do. Given the way that the committee substitute was drafted, and I'm looking at page 21, lines 19 and 20, which says, if the prostitution conviction is vacated by the court shall remove that from court view, essentially, if they weren't convicted of another felony. So that's, of course, brand new in the committee substitute and something that I had not anticipated. But I now have cases with convicted prostitution charges that have other charges. And again, there were about 65 of those if we go back to about 2004. But the number that are felonies are, interestingly, nearly all the state cases. So, but still, that only gives us a handful, possibly fewer than 10 that we were able to locate going back to 2004 that had prostitution plus a felony. So as I read this, those folks would not be removed from court view. However, that individual could nonetheless proceed with a vacation of judgment if they want to for some other reason.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mead. Did you have anything else?
I just would like to clarify something that I think is worth clarifying that was said previously. I do want to say that these cases do not become removed from somebody's record. That is different from vacating a judgment or taking something off of court view. It may be a little bit confusing because thus far in Alaska law, there's no such thing as a vacation of judgment. And but as I read this bill and the way that the court system intends to implement it, those cases would not be removed from somebody's record. They can be removed from court view, but that's completely different.
Thank you for that correction. Any other questions for Ms. Mead? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Mead. So we still have some work to do on this bill. We expect to bring another draft committee substitute forward next week. I'll now set Senate Bill 189 aside. That's the end of the calendar for today. Is there any other business before the committee? Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 23rd at 1:30 p.m. And today we're adjourned at 2:31 p.m.